And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and myself, Bill Tupel. In our last radio show, the whole thing shifted towards poetry. And I'm so glad that that's finally leaked in to our addressing of the nature of the art process, because in some ways I think poetry most gets at this thing we've been discussing, because it's like, it's such a pointer pointing directly at the what of existence. And if it goes off of that, it starts to become prose. So the poet is constantly, his place is to stay situated where life itself is speaking through him. I know I've always been very fond of poetry, although I don't even read it much anymore. Donna had a good quote.
Well, yeah, although you just took it off into this wonderful rarefied level, and the quote is a little bit on a different level, but I guess it leads to the rarefied
level, too. Well, we could come back
too.
To your quote.
No, I think I like opposites together. This is a A.E. Housman quote. It's from that same book I mentioned last week called Creators on Creating. He said, "I could no more define poetry than a terrier can define a rat, but we both recognize the object by the symptoms it provokes in us."
Which brings up the great Barnett Newman quote that, if I can remember it, aesthetics is as important to artists as ornithology is to birds. The artist no more needs to be concerned with aesthetics as much as.
Yeah, speaking of murdering fine impulses. I used aesthetics as a form of revenge when I was writing my thesis in college. My original plan for a thesis was very ambitious, and it was based on Ernst Cassirer's philosophy of symbolic forms, and it was going to be quite a challenge for me. And I was really kind of unsure about whether I'd be able to pull it off, but I was determined to make it work, and I was filled with ideas and very excited and energized by it. And my advisory committee decided that it was too ambitious and that I shouldn't do it. And so instead, I did a series of constructivist sculptures, a series of paintings, and they required something written. So the written thing, instead of Alan Cobb's philosophy of symbolic forms, was simply a statement of my philosophy of aesthetics. And I figured I couldn't write anything more useless than a definition of aesthetics. So I did, and it sits in the library to this day. And it basically says that you can't define what art is, no matter how hard you try. So, you know, get over it.
So getting back then, because that's true, I think we all agree that that's true, to what Housman said about what it evokes in us.
Yeah.
The symptoms it invokes in us. So let's talk about that. What are the symptoms that poetry, good art, you know, we're standing in a museum in front of a painting, maybe even a very uneducated person about art has no idea what this artist's life was like or anything, and yet stands in front of that painting and something happens, something powerful happens standing in front of that painting. What is that?
Well, I think it evokes our finest qualities, the finest impulses, and this is bringing us back to the Henry Miller last time. Our most basic impulses, I mean, I'm really that's about where I want to stop. Our most basic impulses of being being an aware consciousness.
Yeah.
And so it's a I think there's recognition. There's recognition of myself as an aware consciousness. And what is that? Mm. What is that? An aware consciousness. What is consciousness? And what is going on here? Once again, we're back to art seems to have something to do with evoking life itself. Life itself, the what it is, begins to be spoken.
And it reminds me of the the film we watched on Video Night last week, where one of the artists that was being interviewed said, you know how you never see artists on talk shows? Because he said the first reason is because only 14 out of the 1,000 people in the audience have ever heard of them. Second of all, you ask them a question and they'll give you a 3-word answer. And I've noticed that with a lot of the interviews you see with visual artists, they are at the same loss for words as you just were in trying to answer that particular question, because that's the reason why they're saying it in paint and form instead of words, because it is something that is both expressed and communicated and understood on a level that's beyond words.
Yeah. I have there are a couple of poems in my cave paintings book that have stuck with me for many years and survived the final edit before I let that one out. And I honestly don't know how to say a single thing about what those poems mean. All I can say is they're, abstract expressionist poems. They do not translate. They are not symbolic. The concepts, the visual images in them have no analogy that I can come up with. I don't know why I wrote them. I don't know what I was thinking when I wrote them. But when I read them, I know what they're saying. It's just something in a domain where we don't have any language.
Now, why do you think it is that so many people, though, actually get almost hostile if something like that isn't explained to them? There's a lot of people who just they read a poem and it just makes them mad that they can't understand it.
I think a lot of people are, because of the way we're taught poetry in school, that it's something you're supposed to analyze and interpret. I think they just naturally feel challenged by some kind of puzzle that they're supposed to be smart enough to unravel. And if they can't figure out what it means with a good margin of safety, then they feel like, some kind of cruel joke is being perpetrated.
Like, and they're stupid. So it's a cultural, it's like one of our cultural dilemmas.
It's one of the many ways that mediocre education has, has damaged the students instead of inspiring them. And it can happen anywhere to anybody. It wasn't necessarily a bad teacher who gives a person that reaction to poetry. It may just be the combination of that teacher's approach and that student's, approach.
And what's valued in our whole society as opposed to some ancient society or, mythic society that's based on mythology and ritual rather than productivity like ours.
Yeah,
the purpose of art is squeezing in here, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And it's its own, it's for its own reason. I mean, for art's sake, guy, I guess. It's its own reason. It certainly has no understand, is it to be understood? Even the purpose to be understood, it's not even to be understood.
Yeah.
It's its own, it sits there being a battery of meaning that can't be explained. And you stand in front of it and you'll get, even if it's, we're even talking about bad art and bad poetry. It is a battery of meaning. And you stand there, you're going to get its meaning.
Yeah.
So it's not even a matter of that the purpose here is to be good or bad. I mean, we're getting at the what of getting out of bed.
Yeah. my dad was a surgeon and a poet, and but he loved probably more than anything else telling stories. You'd never guess from interacting with me, I guess. But his when asked, why do you like to tell stories so much, his response was a little sort of micro poem, which was, ain't nobody has so much fun as people. And basically, you just say, you know, it's just look around you. If you don't see stories, I can't help you, you know.
Well, there's this thing, too, that happens to anybody who's drawn to being an artist, whether they're looking at it as a career kind of choice or whether it's just, you know, something that they do because they love it. You just can't stop doing it. The impulse is just kind of there. Right. And like Picasso, who I keep using him as an example just because I probably have studied him and know more about him than other artist, but he had pressure on him to make a living from his art because he hated poverty, absolutely couldn't stand living in poverty and, you know, having no heat in his horrible apartment or no room to paint. And yet, at the same time, he couldn't paint what the dealers wanted. So there was always this like intense pull inside him because when he first started painting in Paris and was doing like street scenes in the cafes and stuff like that in the early years, people loved it and he was selling lots of art. Like initially he had this first beginner's wave of success, and then when his friend committed suicide and he became kind of depressed and started doing the blue period paintings, nobody wanted them because, wait a second, this is the guy who does like these cool cafe scenes and what the heck is he doing these paintings for?
Not to mention they're a downer.
And they're a downer, right. And so nobody wanted them for a long time. And in fact, nobody really started buying the blue period paintings until long after he was out of that phase and he was famous for something else. But within himself, strong as the impulse was to get out of poverty and make a living with his art, he could not do it. He couldn't paint what he didn't want to actually or have to say.
But this is what we've been saying about the truthfulness.
Yeah, exactly.
Being truthful with yourself. And if you're truthful with yourself, you just can't do that stuff. You just have to do what you have to do, which seems to drive every meaningful artist and seems to be what we're looking for from the artist.
And yet some artists, like you were talking about at Odd Thursday, are able to, quote, keep their day job. Like there are artists who maybe can make a living doing illustrations for magazines or,
well, that's one way to
do
this.
Calligraphy or something like that while they're doing the deep, soulful, authentic, honest work as well. But other people like Picasso can't. It's just too big, the thing that wants to come out, to dilute it even with a day job.
Yeah, and most and some of the real major figures have just had to go for it 24 hours a day and starve for a while, even though they've got this, even they might like nice things, but most of them will choose starving over compromising their work to have nice things. And it's, you know, there's story after story of that in the arts. But I think that there's also the other angle. You know, you do something to make some money, and then you block out enough time that you can devote yourself deeply to your art.
Maybe there's no connection at all between the artist and the quality of life. And you get some quality of life according to some set of karmic rules, and what you do within that quality of life is a whole separate issue. I often think that that might be the case. at least in my own life. Well, it's sort of like, you know, if your destiny is not to be a millionaire, then, you know, you're not going to be a millionaire, and you can compromise your art and make it as commercial as possible, and you still won't be a millionaire.
Right, and that happens constantly.
And and if your destiny is to be world famous and successful, then maybe, you know, you also are a great artist, and your fame and success will be seen in that context. But it might just be that, you know, everybody has to make the same choices, and those who choose to, you know, try and live for this unnameable essence that, you know, we're all extolling are more obvious if they're in the arts than they are if they're in auto mechanics. But we've been here before, too. I just did a 32-show flashback.
And it did hit me very strongly when you were describing Picasso's situation, that it's all karma, you know.
Yeah.
That he didn't have to get a job with some karmic event. It wasn't so much that he refused to get a job or that he couldn't have done what he did while having a side job. Well, it's just he was lucky enough, I guess.
Well, and he was persuasive enough that he kept like begging his relatives back in Spain when he was utterly broke to give him a little bit more money. And at one point he, you know, after that first, when he entered this blue period paintings, he actually had to go back and live at his parents' house again in Barcelona in order to, for like many months before he could go back to Paris again. So it's interesting. I mean, you were talking, Alan, about stories and how interesting people are with all of their stories. To me, it's very, very not only inspiring, but reassuring to read all of the lives of the artists. Mm-hmm. Because if you only study what you've learned in art history classes in school, you know such a surface level of the most famous parts of their story that you don't really realize how essentially human and earthbound a lot of these iconic figures actually have been.
And how they were dealing with the same stuff we're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. It helps you.
I had a thought there, and I lost it.
Well, you were talking, Alan, about the recycled topics on the show. I think it's basically because our whole radio show, no matter what our start-off topic is, we're really always trying to get at exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's a one-topic radio series, and the reason why it has so many different aspects that we can talk about is because this topic is like the trunk of a huge tree that has branched off throughout history in a zillion different directions, born fruit, dropped the fruit, seeded, grown new sprouts and all that. And so it's really an inexhaustible topic.
One of the things that came to mind on the last show that I didn't mention and it just popped back into my head, When Henry Miller was talking about, I forget his exact choice of words, but destroying the fine impulses, it occurred to me maybe it would be some interest to think a minute about how do we actually go about destroying the fine impulses? What are these things that we do that we ought to be mindful of prevent us from living in the present or prevent us from being spontaneous or prevent us from allowing those fine impulses to express themselves. And of course, the most obvious one, which we have discussed, is just intellectualizing, analyzing. And yet there's a fascinating subtlety to the notion of intellect. On the one hand, we think of it in sort of a common jargon sense as, you know, the faculty with which we analyze and get verbal. And certainly, you know, you can talk about something with increasingly precise, you know, language and get more and more specific and accurate and precise about what you're saying to the point where you almost can't even think about anything else. And the conversation is kind of preordained that, it has to go down this incredibly narrow intellectual track. But then there's another aspect of intellect, which is simply the faculty that chooses, the faculty that decides whether to go left or right when you come to a fork in the road. And to me, the present is that place where those decisions are being made at all times. In a sense, we're living constantly with the intellect, but the intellect is operating without language.
Right.
And that seems to be the key. It's operating at this level of direct perception that there's left and there's right, and I will go right. Left and right, and I will go left. And these are this is the moment of truth, but it's only about a millisecond long.
And the slaughtering of the fine impulses, I think, often when you're faced with that crossroads, a little mm-hmm. fork you're talking about, for me anyway, it tends to come from emotions.
Mm-hmm.
That the intellect is steered to one direction or another because of some habit of emotions. And for an artist, at least for me in my studio, those emotions are often, oh yeah, but if I do that, everybody's going to think it's really stupid.
No, and this is the first thing that came to mind when you talked mm-hmm. about slaughtering is caring what people think.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Is
yeah.
probably the worst. Yeah. Slaughterer. And and you immediately are off of what he's just described. Now, what he just described is really living with our natural intellect, because yeah. you can't paint a painting without making discriminating choices.
Right.
You red or green.
Right.
Oh, yes, red and green and mm-hmm. blue and line and curve. And it's just like that. And you're making... It's like riding a wave,
mm-hmm.
and the intellect is spontaneously choosing, and you don't even know if it's you choosing or something mm-hmm. else.
Yeah, yeah.
When it's right, it's this thing where you start to, it's almost like starting to watch yourself making decisions and starting to doubt. I mean, there's doubt, I think, is like
doubt
the
is
greatest
killer.
Enemy.
Yeah, doubt
and
is
fear
a killer.
Of not being original, too, I think, is, I mean, because all of these quotes we read by these greatest artists talk about what's being communicated as something universal, but in our culture right now, in the art scene, there's a real putting of originality on a pedestal, and conceptual art, you know, you just come up with some concept that's like, nobody's ever done this before, and it is really, really cool, you know. And I would often have an impulse to do something in my studio and think, shoot, what's original about that? You know, like, that's not clever. Nobody's going to look at that and say, whoa, isn't she amazing? Again, it's what do people think, but it's what do people think in a certain...
Yeah, but it's part of the modernist contemporary art world, and
right.
it goes back a ways especially. But there was a time when I think painting the Madonna for the 10,000th time with life, the life of the Virgin and the Christ child really in there was considered to be the highest thing. But today there's a premium put on something that's different.
Yeah.
And I think it's the biggest mistake, probably the biggest mistake of the contemporary art scene.
Yeah.
Because there's no particularly inherent value in doing something that's different. Unless that difference stirs this thing we've been describing.
Right, yeah. Right. Exactly.
That's the only reason to do anything different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had to confront that when I started working in sound composition, because the area I wanted to explore was timbre and spatiality, and those are two aspects of sound that are very easily overshadowed by melody and harmony and rhythm. So for me to go where I wanted to go, I had to eliminate music in most senses of the word, which meant that I was making, you know, these purely synthetic sounds or bits and pieces of sound taken from the natural world, but taken out of context. And if you start looking around, you'll find that everyone who has ever purchased a synthesizer has played with the sound of the synthesizer. The timbre of it certainly is one of the most exciting things to discover when you start messing around with a synth for the first time. And as a result, there's just thousands and thousands of recordings that all sound the same, and they all sound terrible. They all sound boring, and they're all just someone naively discovering that, oh, wow, look, if I just hold this note and wiggle this knob, it sounds really interesting. And it does if you've never heard it before, but that's the only reason it sounds interesting. It's because it's new and you know, never been experienced. And so I had this challenge to come up with sounds that were, in fact, really interesting and that could sustain your interest and that wouldn't be mistaken for the stuff that, you know, anybody's going to be generating in the first 15 minutes that they mess around with a synthesizer. So it was you know, it was very much influenced by the issue of what other people will think, but it was partly because it's what I would think also if I heard that. I mean, there are certain things I just won't do, certain kinds of filter sweeps that are done so much that they're just horrendously trite. But the irony is that as that whole area develops as a branch of artistic expression, then there are subtleties that are not there just because you've never heard them before. They're there because they're fascinatingly subtle. Mm. And so suddenly filter sweeps that I've been avoiding like the plague maybe will become part of our vocabulary, and then we'll be able to use them at a whole new level of subtlety.
And what you said just then, to me, sparked off about six other topics that we could go off in.
Now the next six shows.
Yeah, because the point about what other people think, there is, it's a two-sided issue.
It brings to the point this concept of balance.
And
if you go this way, then you actually have to parry it with its opposite to keep everything in balance.
Exactly,
so we'll say one thing, and then you pretty much have to say the opposite thing for everything to be covered.
That could be our next topic, the play of opposites.
Okay.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.